Welcome to Bartender at Large. I'm your host, Eric Castro. And as usual, I'm joined by some of the biggest names in the industry. With me today, owner and master blender of Maison Ferrand, Alexander Gabriel.
Hello.
Brother, thank you so much for joining us. I'm super excited to have you, not only because obviously your reputation in the industry as a blender and you know the incredible products you make, but your products are some of my favorite to not only drink, but to also make cocktails with.
Oh, thank you.
You know, you have the Plantation Series rums, Citadel Gin, you know, obviously the beautiful cognacs that you make. There's so much to talk about with you. You know, I'm wondering how we're going to fit this all in a half an hour. But I guess I'm just going to start at the beginning. How did you start?
Oh, that was long ago. That was 29 years ago. So next year is going to be 30 years doing this. And it seems, like the old farce always tell you, it seems like yesterday. And it started very, very small and started really with a dream. And I grew up on a farm in South Burgundy with my grandparents' farm with a bunch of cousins. We're six people. Mm-hmm. And we learned to make wine and to do farming. And it's always
How
stayed
old were you when
me.
You learned to make wine?
I was harvesting when I was, we didn't go to school when it was during the harvest. So harvesting was cool because you get to skip school, you know. Yeah. So you had all the farmers were not at school. I grew up in a little village. It's, you know, of 60 people. Mm-hmm. And the school was the next by village.
Were you like 10 years old, 12 years old?
Oh, we were in the vineyards as soon as you could walk to do harvesting. And you had your role, and with the cousins, we would compete, you know, and sometimes skip a few grapes just to be ahead. And, you know, and then we would be yelled at, you know. So I did that from a young age. And you see, school was very different in Burgundy when there was harvesting and not. So to me, that was very meaningful. I always thought I had a very stern grandfather, an old gentleman that went through Second World War and whatnot. He always, for him, you know, the wealth was in the land. And it's something that stayed with me forever. And to me, it still baffles me. You know, you and I are sharing a business. It's farming. We are in the farming business. You know, whether you're a bartender, all the bartenders listening, we are in the farming business. And yet, you know, it's just, to me, a situation. I don't mean to digress, but the people who feed us, all the farmers in the world, in France or, you know, as well as many countries, are the guys who are going to have a very hard time making a living. And I always thought, you know, this is strange that people who make us, you know, who feed us cannot do this. And I always thought it would be a great challenge to actually have a farming activity. You could have a community and a team that can make a living with. Now, I took the easy road because if you do wine or cognac, which is a farming activity, is the one that is easier in a way. If you look, I mean, it's a lot of hard work, you know, of course, but easier to turn into something you can actually make money from. And, you know, in a second life, my dream would be the perfect tomato, making the perfect tomato or the perfect raspberries or, you know, from farming and hoping you can actually make money from it. But, you know, for me, I've learned to make wine. My grandfather was also bouilleur de cru, you know, distiller of his own crop. This is the name. And so I've learned this. And to him, you know, cognac was like that shining star, mm-hmm. you know, and when you have a mentor that has like a hero as a person or as a product, it rubs off on you. And that was kind of like the roots of what I became, I guess.
That's just so fascinating because to me, it's just like, no, just picturing you as a child, just walking through the, you know, these pastoral groves, picking grapes. It conjures up such an image of like, in my mind, that's like the stereotype and the story that I want to tell myself of a cognac blender. And it's so cool that that's actually the way that you grew up. So at what point in your life did you actually stop and start to think like, hey, you know what, maybe I could do this for a living?
Well, that's, you know, I was a kind of teenager that was not easy, and I'm sure a lot of us are like that. But school was always, you know, ups and downs. If I loved that teacher, I would like be up there. And like we had a great philosophy teacher, you know, when I was right before my graduation of high school. But, you know, I remember French teacher was horrible. And I always thought, I got to do something with myself because I'm going to be in a lot of trouble. Now, my cousins went into music. We have a family with music, but also went into farming or winemaking. Mm-hmm. But I always thought, if I work for somebody else, I'm going to be fired all the time because I'm always going to be, you know, fighting that I don't agree we should do it like this. And I knew that about myself. So, you know what I did? I didn't speak English. I said I should go abroad. I didn't have any direction. I went to Minnesota and all places to learn English. I felt if I go there, you know, it's going to be so different. Probably not a lot of French people there. So I had to learn the language. And I did. I also I love music. There was a Prince over there with First Time in You. We went to see all the concert. Yeah. I thought that was so cool. When you are from this tiny little village and you see all of this, I was like, this is really great. And that's I was 19 amazing. Years old. And then I realized, I have to have my own little joint. I said, you should learn about business. So I enrolled into a business school, and it was expensive. And I studied in New York and in Tokyo. And I said, to make some money, I should help farm producers to export their products. So long story short, we created a little company with a guy, a classmate, and to help wine producers. There was a hay baling system. I mean, mm-hmm. if you know to harvest hay, a system that I was tried to sell to John Deere back then. It didn't work, but we had many meetings. So long story short, we finally one of our person that we were working for was a little farmer in Cognac, and they were ready to close shop, basically, at the time. And he said, come over. And I was 22 years old, and it felt right. And it was not an easy situation. We started really from nothing. We were five or six people. I'm proud to say that three of the ladies that started with me are still with me now, 29 years later. They've learned to use a computer and all these things. We were at, the two of them were at bottling. The other one, Annabelle, was on a forklift and still. And my commitment was to the small team, I will always reinvest, because we have a dream, we should make it happen together. And so, last week we bought a little piece of a vineyard extra, so we reinvest everything. So we did Cognac, and that was so hard, man. The first 10 years was bankruptcy around the corner every minute. Now you're thinking micro distillation. This is such a trend with, the craft distilling movement, all of that. There was nothing like this on the horizon. We're just the oddballs trying to make unique products. And that's how it started.
And then, okay, so we're talking, 20, almost 20, 30 years ago, right? And you're talking about
1989.
Wow. Okay. 1989, that helps put it in better context. But think about the actual, the actual year. So here you are, you told me it was really hard work. You had a small team, obviously a very loyal team, because many of them are still with you. And you told me bankruptcy was around the corner. I'm guessing, every day was stressful. But what kept you going?
There's ups and downs. I was trained also by a very traditional cognac master blender, and I said, treat me like you would treat. He thought I had talent, and you always choose your next generation. Now it's funny, because full circle, my son is 20, he wants to be there. I'm not going to be treating him, I'm going to treat him nice, but to learn. And so I took him to Mexico with Ron Cooper for almost a week, to learn to make pechuga and different stuff. So trying to prepare him. And I was prepared differently. I remember one day the Lowe's, we have to, when you learn, taste 60 barrels a day. And one day I was so tired after working all day. And I went to my place, and I was so broken physically, so tired. I drew myself a big bath, and I put all the barrel samples next to the bathtub. And I started drinking and tasting and trying to take notes. And all the same times, I realized actually a cognac snifter floats in your bath, by the way. It's an interesting tip I want everybody to know.
Hold on, I'm writing that down.
It does, absolutely. And I was just doing all these experiments, and it went from a low to like, I like this. I'm going to do this for the rest of my life. In something that was defining for me, that guy who trained me, one day I started to do blends. A long time to make a blend, to have a perfect blend. It takes time. And I had made a blend that I was very proud of, and I wanted to show it to him. And I said, what do you think? And he looks at me, and he looked at me again, and he said, this is good, and so on. And I said, well, thank you very much. And he said, no, thank you. This is not a compliment. I said, what is it? Good, usually, in my language, it's a compliment. No. What you have to make, good products, the people drinking it are going to decide. It's got to be memorable. Think of a good book and a memorable book. So you should have it in you to make products that move the needle. So, and every single product we make, we as a group always wonder, is this moving the needle? Is it saying something that's meaningful? And then you decide, Eric, if you like it or not. This is not my privilege. My privilege is to dream up something with the team. And I think I know that about me now. I'm very imaginative. But to dream out products that are different. Recently, we are launching the Jamaica Special Dry. It's a Jamaican, 100% pot still, a blend of Long Pond and Clarendon. I wanted to do Jamaican that drew back to a certain culture of Jamaica. And there's other wonderful products in Jamaica, don't get me wrong, and I have a lot of respect for them. But I wanted to make a product that had its roots in the 19th century where it was 100% pot still rum, very elegant, yet very intense. There was a guy called James C. Nolan, I'm not going to discuss this today, but was a Jamaican that was a late 1800s, early 20th century, and I read a lot of his interviews. And this guy was very feisty, had a vision about Jamaican rum, and he's kind of my hero for this product. And so we wanted to make a product that, and modestly again, but that says, this is our take on Jamaica. It's 100% pot still. It's heavy, and it is, yet it's balanced, and it's a blend of Long Pond and Clarendon. And that is defining for me whether it is a cognac, whether it is a gin, or whether it is a rum.
Okay, I like that. I think a lot of actually what you're saying, just in regards to the business, is like, and your vision could be applied to just about anything, not just spirits. And that's why it's so fascinating for me to hear. It's like, in today's market, where the spirits industry, where the bar industry is at, it's no longer just good enough to be good. You have to be memorable, and you have to fulfill a need that no one else is fulfilling. That's why I feel like your products have been doing so well, especially, you know, just even with, your cognacs. I love just like how the proof's just a little higher than the competitors, you know? So it's like when I'm making a cocktail, it comes out better. Your rums, I could go on forever. That Plantation 5-year is like, I pour so much of it at pretty much all my bars.
Thank you.
And, you know, so we've talked a little bit about the rums and the cognac, and then how did Citadel come about? Well, tell us about the gin.
Citadel, remember, you start, you have the stills, they're there. And cognac, I don't know if you know, can only distill during the winter, because when the wine has to be fresh, there's the wine to make cognac is very pure. There's no sulfite load, so wine doesn't keep. You have to make a great cognac, you have to distill right off fermentation. And so the rest of the year, your stills are sitting there. And I thought, man, this is crazy. We got these beautiful stills. We have the know-how. You got the imagination going like crazy. Now think, the rules of cognac is 23 pages. The rule of gin is 2 paragraphs. So it also felt like, go on, my friend, just create something. And it took us 5 years to convince French government that we could use our own still to make cognac, obviously. Because,
are you serious?
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, man, that bureaucracy is crazy.
But it was actually a present, because we were able to... I say that in retrospect, I was pissed off. But it was a way to actually learn, experience, and go for it all the way. And so we have these stills that are sitting there, and that are the original still. A cognac still is just a primitive still in a noble sense. You know, it's a very simple apparatus. You warm up, you condensate. And we thought it would be great to me, like, again, our vision about gin. Very intensive. It's about juniper berries, but not in a sharp way, but in a very holistic way. And so I'm proud to say now I own a patent, for gin making. So once again, we think we moved the needle a little bit. And then we made one of the first reserve gin, you know, with the Citadel Reserve. Mm-hmm. Now that's finished in a wooden vat that's shaped like an egg. It's like a giant wooden egg. You know, that's a very specific technique for blending.
What's the philosophy behind that? How does that shape of a barrel impart different flavor?
Well, you know, with Citadel Reserve, remember, there's no specific rules about gin making. You can actually use barrels from any type of essence of wood that you can. So I'm using barrels made of acacia. My grandfather was making wine in acacia barrels. That works beautiful for gin. I mean, beautiful. You don't have the heavy tannins. You have the very floral elements. We're using mulberry, chestnuts. We're using barrels made of cherry trees. And that's just incredible. The only thing, with the dominant of acacia. Now, if you want to blend this, you know, you want something that's seamless, that's beautiful. So what you do there, I was wondering how we can, like, that last step. And when you're a master blender, you also do work about barreling, you know. And so some of my friends now working at barrel, companies. And one guy, there's like a group of four, they're geniuses. And they created this vat that is egg-shaped, so there's no angle. So actually it blends perfectly inside on its own with the movement of earth and warm and cold. And so the liquid, you know, in an almost imperceptible way, you know, is moving inside, and you create that very, very, very well integrated blend. So it's a big wooden vat. You see one, you want one for your living room. It's beautiful. The only big problem, it's a little expensive, you know, but it's a piece of art. Every stave takes 50 tree to choose that stave. The rest is making regular barrels. It's not thrown away, of course. But so it's very special. It's just a little step, you know, at the end of making Citadel Reserve with this big egg that was made for us to that purpose.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of the gin as well, especially, you know, a Martinez with the barrel aged gin is, it's a beautiful thing.
Oh, thank you. I love it.
It's a beautiful thing. So, you know, I'm going to back it up a little bit. I'm going to talk about, ask you about the rums. So at what stage did you decide to, like, you know, were you like, you know what, this whole cognac thing, I think I got that figured out. I'm going to go down to the Caribbean. I'm going to source some beautiful rum for plantation. At what point did you first envision this? And also, did people think you were crazy?
Well, they still do, right? Yeah. You know, right now in cognac, I'm doing a lot of research about the ancient techniques. We created a foundation, Eric, you know, it's called the Ferrand Plantation Foundation, where we actually are researching the old techniques of cognac and rum making. And it's fascinating. I'm going to throw a little something at you. You know, we discovered at Weinstein's Rum Distillery that in the archives from the late 1800s, that they were making certain batch by using seawater in a fermenting tank.
Whoa.
Seawater. And the distillery is right on the beach. So, and I was talking with a good friend of mine, Dave Wondrich, and he mentioned, and this guy has done a lot of research too. That's why we're like kind of, say, brother from the bottom of the ball, the punch ball. and you know, we are, and he says, you know, remember, there is some guys that use a pinch of salt in Jamaica for fermentation. So it creates a stress on yeast, and the taste is totally different. So now, why shouldn't we explore that again? And of course, we're making it, so it's not commercially available, but we're having so much fun digging deep into this terroir. Terroir is a wide sense. To me, terroir is the produce of nature and humankind. This is the interaction of nature and humankind in a specific place, right? So Jamaica with the funky rums that I love, you know, that's the culture and that's terroir. So rum, I fell in love with it in a very unexpected way. Gin was kind of, as you know, kind of programmed, right? Mm-hmm. And so how that happened was I had extra barrels to sell. And we always, you know, I liked rum, but I didn't know as much about rum that I knew about gin and cognac, as you can imagine. I was an amateur at the time of rum, I have to say. And so I went to the Caribbean to try to sell some barrels, met some producers in Haiti. I'm going to Haiti next week, so it's an emotional moment. Mm-hmm. And met you know, people who are from Haiti, and their daughter worked with us, this Barbancourt, the Gardère family. Thierry passed away now, one of my mentors for rum. I have two or three. And I went there, it was very humbling. I discovered things about fermentation that were like, I thought I had it down. And I was like, wow, these guys rock. This is like so marvelous, so incredible. And I wanted to learn everything about it. And then I went to Barbados, I went to St. Lucia, met another of my mentor, Laurie Barnard, from St. Lucia Distillers. We did so much things together, including four or five vintages. And then
what was the general attitude that these distillers in the Caribbean were or had for you? Were they welcoming? Were they secretive?
Were they a little
suspicious of who's this French guy trying to learn our secrets?
That's depending who, right? Uh-huh. But all in all, very welcoming. Mm-hmm. And like, again, very humbling, because you come, you're from cognac, and cognac has, you know, you're a master blender. I'm also a distiller, distiller. So, you know, I discovered Cullen distillation. Imagine, in cognac, it's almost a curse word. I mean, it's a curse word. You know, when you say Cullen, you don't say asshole, you say Cullen, you know. Cullen distillation is something that, and I discovered it. And I said, some Cullen rums was delicious, and fermentation, again, was magical. And these guys were very welcoming, because, you know, most of them says, you know, tell me your things and I'll tell you my things. And at least two or three of these guys, and they, Laurie Barnard from St. Lucia opened the doors to the Caribbean's door for me, calling his friends. And we started, and the story of plantation was harvesting these barrels that have started being distilled there and aged there and shipping them to cognac they can go through that second aging, kind of a journey that was very traditional in the, 1700s and 1800s. And we try as much as possible to ship it in the barrel. So the movement also of that barrel and that double aging. And that's the signature of plantation was really the sense of terroir, that every island, you know, sometimes you hear people want to classify rum by saying, okay, you have the Spanish style, French style, and English style. That's not enough. Mm-mm. I'm not even sure it means something, to be honest with you. I would put a big question mark on it. My suggestion, there's a culture per country. Mm-hmm. You know, otherwise it's like saying, okay, there's French wine, Italian wine, and American wine, and you got three styles there. Well, really.
I mean, think of how mad that, like, the wine world would be, how offended they would be
if you ever made a comment like that. And so to me, I mean, and respectfully, I mean, some people see it differently, but here, I think it's by country. I mean, you have, like, Jamaica is a culture. You know, Barbados is really a culture. Trinidad is another culture. And I'm working with Liam Costello from Fiji, you know, and there's like that pot still made with a friend of mine called David Pym many, many years ago. That's like this real John Doe still, and he's making this beautiful Fiji rum that we're going to launch soon.
Had a Fiji rum. It's incredible. They made rum in Fiji.
Yeah, yeah, and it's great pot still rum, and they have a column too, but we do the pot still. So really, it's about these beautiful cultures that we're trying to showcase, to work with, and to use, to really do a conjugation of two know-how, the know-how what I've learned in the Caribbean, and of course, using our skills, you know, to age and blend.
Okay, one thing I want to bring up and note is I notice you keep coming back to pot stills. You keep referencing, like, oh yes, you know, the quality from a pot still in regards to a cognac and these folks in Fiji. For the listeners out there who don't really understand the difference between like a column still and a pot still, why is it that you love the pot still so much?
Well, you know, the pot still is the oldest apparatus to distill, and it's a very simple yet beautiful way to distill. It's got a little problem. It is very temperamental. You have to be right there, take care of it. It's almost impossible to automate a pot still distillation as opposed to column because it needs attention. But the beauty of it is extremely precise. A, and B, you can concentrate flavors in a beautiful way. So you have great power. You have a you're like touching what you're distilling. And you can cut the heads and the tails so precisely. You know, I'll give you an example. Mm-hmm. You know you're going to age a cognac longer, you cut the tails a little low. So you actually get stuff that is kind of off note purposely. Mm-hmm. And that is one of your blending elements later. And also that age, as this age is going to become very complex, pot still gives you that precision. And sometimes you can purposely distill an off note. When I train my staff, I'll tell you a little story. It's actually a horrible analogy, but I cannot help myself.
I love bad analogies.
When I train my staff, you know, I always say the perfect blend always has an unperceivable off note. And by the way, I think it's the same with a great cocktail, but here I am an amateur. Yeah. You know, I'm talking about the stuff I know what to do. And what happened is, I'm trying to explain that to the team, that because if it's just perfect, it's like somebody who's perfectly looking, you know, it's boring. You want somebody who's got style, you know, that's so something that's memorable. That's the same. The perfect blend that's going to move that needle, it's got that. And I'm always thinking, there was a president of France called De Gaulle. One day he had a president coming from abroad. I tell this to the team. And De Gaulle loved andouillette. I don't know what it is. You know what is andouillette? It's actually a tripe sausage. Mm-hmm. And it's made with the pig stripes. And the guy's looking, you're eating this? And it smells a bit like a barnyard. It's delicious. And the guy's there, and the other guy says, you eat this? He says, I love andouillette when it's well prepared with the mustard sauce. And the guy is like, apparently not so comfortable. He says, you want some? He says, I don't know. He said, you know, andouillette, it's made with the tripes, and it's got to have that intensity of taste. The best andouillette always have that tiny little bit of shit in it that makes it very special. But he said, too much shit, you throw up, you know? Now, I know it's a bad analogy, right? But it's striking in a sense that if you make a perfect blend, you need to find that distillate that's got that little off note that is introduced in such a delicate way that you're going to be, wow, there's something in there. But if you do it wrong, it's just a disaster. The roof caves in, it falls on your head. And, you know, that was one of my trainings. Now, pot still, remember, your question. And then column still is very different. Column still is a very modern apparatus. It's a continuous apparatus. It's cheaper to run. I think column is very adapted to lighter, more flowery, with a little hint maybe of spice type of rums. That's my take. And where pot still gives you that intensity. I love intense spirits, obviously. I like to hug the terroir it's from.
Yes.
To me, that's so key. And so the pot still is magical. I love the rum funk of Jamaica. You cannot do this in a column. You need a pot to concentrate these elements that I've developed in this super long fermentation, because you got the precision to distill and concentrate. That's why I think a pot still is magical. It's a wonderful tool.
And then another word I wanted to ask you about is you keep referring to terroir. And I know for a lot of our listeners out there, they keep thinking, no, terroir is for wine. Why does this guy keep talking about terroir and spirits? You know, but you know, like you said, it's like so much of it's reflective of the agriculture. You know, these are agricultural products that we're talking about, and they reflect not only the agriculture but also the culture that they come from. Why is it that you think terroir is such an important part of spirits?
You know, spirits are product of agriculture. You grow something. Mm-hmm. There's always a farmer growing something, whatever you drink. So, you know, when you have a plant that grows, that plant's going to have a different taste, especially fruit-based spirits. The expression of that plant is super, super important. Like, you know, the Fruto de Vis cognac is a fruit also. Obviously, it's grapes. And it's the same for every spirit, by the way. And to me, terroir is not only that, but it's also the interaction of the maker, the creator, the farmer. A farmer is a creator. You know, he's planting things, he's growing things. And the way he's doing this is going to be very important. So you have what nature gives you. That's why I'm for the diversity, the biodiversity, because that gives you more tools as a farmer. And also, so terroir to me, basically, is geology, climate. Climate is one of the two. And is know-how, you know, like talent, history, heritage. You know, the way you make rum in Jamaica is very different than the way you make rum in Trinidad or in Fiji, as a matter of fact, or in Barbados. So to me, terroir is that holistic thing of where you have not only, you know, sometimes people try to summarize terroir as like being this almost Rousseau, and, you know, was a French philosopher that was very idealistic, that says that little plant grows on its own and that's it. No, that's an interaction between talent, know-how, and nature. And to me, that's what terroir, and that's what creates these specific flavor profiles. You know, cognac has terroir, you know, there's a plant that you grow, that you distill with specific stills and so on, with specific fermentation, grape varieties and so on, and specific know-how. So that to me is magic, because without this, you don't have spirits of character.
Yeah, I'm really glad that people are starting to like shift the conversation. Obviously, people like you have shifted the conversation where people are starting to understand that this is all an integral part of the product. And the terroir is something, you know, with like, something like even Ocho Tequila, you know, where it's like, it's all estate grown. They show you where it's from. It's like that, you know, 20 years ago, people wouldn't have understood it. But thanks, because of people like you, who have been pushing the terroir in the spirits world as well as the wine world, it's something I think that's very important. And it's kind of, shifted the needle.
Yeah, I do. And to me, there's like different levels. It seems to me that right now there's like a comeback to terroir. And I'm very happy about the raw material. And I'd like the terroir approach to be holistic, where the cultural aspect of making products. For example, I did a presentation at TAEAS about Thomas Estes from Ocho Tequila. It's funny you mentioned that.
Perfect timing.
And you know, and two other friends, Dave Pickrell, and also Alex from Teeling, and we're talking about blending. That's also to me part of the cultural aspect. That's terroir, because different people have different ways of making the products, that to me is also magical. And this, I'm dedicating a lot of time of my life to research the way people were using. For example, cognac used to be made with barrels made of chestnuts, with barrels made of mulberry, acacia, and cherry trees. And now it's illegal.
What?
Right? It is illegal. You can only make cognac with oak barrels. And it's illegal very recently, 1945. 1945 in the history of cognac is yesterday. Mm-hmm. So my dream, if you say today, I'm going to grant you a dream. You're going to be that genie in that bottle. That would be one of on top of my list is, can we reopen this? And I'm working very hard for this with other people back in cognac. I'm thinking of a very dear friends over there. To say, can we please reopen this to this heritage? And to me, that's terroir as well. Mm-hmm. You know, it's about the plant, but it's about what do we do with it. We have a Citadel Extreme, number two. We are using cherry petals, the plant, but then we're aging it a few months in the barrels made of a cherry tree. So that's the whole holistic approach that to me is terroir, the products and the know-how you know, conjugated and blended together. I feel very strongly about this. I think that know-how, and we're lucky we're in an industry, the same, what happened in the bar, the, all that research that was done by great guys like Dave Wondrich that we've been plugging back, that is feeding the creativity of today. And we operate the same way at Maison Ferrand.
Yeah, and that's so intriguing to me, because really what you're trying to do is, you're not trying to have the rules change just to change. You're trying to take it back to the original history.
Absolutely.
You're trying to protect the heritage.
Absolutely.
More than anything. And is that something that they seem receptive to?
Somebody called me a renegade, and that's why we called, I cannot tell you who, and that's why we called that era, that edition. I was a little bit upset, but now I'm wearing it as a badge of honor, I guess, because what is renegade? We called it the renegade barrel. That's the edition of Ferrand. The first one was aged in a sauterne barrel, which actually cognac now, we were able to establish that that law was never overturned. That was theorized in 1923. Cognac is a spirit aged in a wine barrel or a wine eau de vie barrels. So, and that was never, that was forgotten, but that was never outlawed. Whereas the other type of woods was by default outlawed by cognac is aged in an oak barrel. And so we're trying to reopen this. It took already 10 years I'm working with it. Before my retirement, I may succeed.
Yeah, because when I'm thinking about it, you said the law was changed in 1945. That's obviously the timing of it right after World War II. It was probably had something to do with resources and making sure that, you know, they were allocating, you know, wood and stuff to proper industries. And then it's probably one of those things that just changed and just never changed back.
Yeah, you're right. And you know, you always have to be careful about the about when people say we're going to rationalize it. Uh-huh. You know, it's like, that's when I get nervous. Because creativity, ideas and so on, and they try to rationalize. So they say, okay, most people do oak, and we're gonna say it's oak. But a cognac aged in a chestnut barrel is magical. In fact, the Renegade barrel number 2 is aged. That's my midlife crisis. I didn't get a girlfriend. Tibby, you can trust me. What I did is I said to the guys, and I said, you know, we are going to make something that's back to history. But I had to give up the name cognac. The bottle cannot say cognac legally. And it's scary, you know, you're like working all this life to make this cognac, and yet it's 100% cognac, and I have to call it aged grape eau de vie, you know, so you know.
That's so silly.
It's crazy, right? Yeah. We're using our brand, but still it's kind of, but I think it's worth it. It's worth it, Eric. And if we can move that needle, remember, memorable, so that's important. And so whatever we do for us, we're trying to do this so it moves the needles. I'm not always making friends in the process. I tell you that. Some people say I'm controversial. But in the end, maybe when we, you and I up there with the angels, drinking some of the angel share, and we look down and maybe they forget about us, but maybe some few guys says, oh, there are these crazy old guys that did this and they did that. And actually, we're tasting stuff that are maybe somewhat more interesting or actually different, let's say.
Oh, that's all fascinating. I have one last question for you. What's next? Because I know you, man. I know you're working on something. You were just telling me you're in Oaxaca, and it's like I'm kind of thinking like, okay, what's Maison Ferrand putting out next? What are they working on?
Well, for us, it's really a focus on cognac, gin, and rum for sure. As you've seen, I'm like totally broke now because we invested in the West Indies distillery in Barbados. We now own a third of National Rum of Jamaica, such a dream come true.
Oh, amazing.
It doubled the number of our team. And so we're really working very hard on this. You know, as you know, and on a sad note, we actually had a big fire at Long Pond in Jamaica. A great support to the team. And
that's terrible.
That's a setback, 10-year setback for us. So there's not only good days, there's also bad days. The distillery is okay, but the fermenting tanks are all burned down, 70 fermenting tank, because it's long fermentation. So for us, next is doing what I love most is the creative part of spirits, in these spirits. I have worked with a lot of other master distillers all my life, more than 50. And so to continue having fun with some of the guys, they come over, they see me in cognac, and we create these five-legged pigs, you know, or sheeps that we mostly drink ourselves. And sometimes one of them escaped the box and makes it to market when my team thinks it's not too crazy. And that's what's next. We're going to continue doing this. The Jamaica Special Dry that went out to market actually, just the week after, you know, where Long Pond burned down, so it's a sign of hope, I hope, you know, is really what we love to be doing. So working with Cognac, I'm going to tell you a little secret. Mm-hmm. We purchased a winery and a Cognac distillery in Borderie. So as you know, we are the expert mm-hmm. of Grand Champagne, but my little darling also was Grand Champagne and still is, but also Borderie. It's just like Grand Champagne would be Jamaica, Borderie would be Barbados. So that's what's next. And in 2020, you'll see hopefully a beautiful Borderie expression of Cognac that we are preparing with all the old stocks, and I'm preparing that. So, but be ready. You know, if the team agrees, you'll see more unique stuff coming out. You know, sometimes they think it's too out there, but this is what feeds me. So you can be ready for many more new expressions. And that's why if I worked for a company, remember we said, mm-hmm. what they like to rationalize, mm-hmm. I'd be fired like probably every week.
No, but see that the innovation in not only for the future, but also, you know, resurfacing stuff from the past. That's what those bartenders, that's what we love. You know, whether it's like the Plantation OFTD or, you know, Plantation 5-year, any of the cognacs you're doing, these grape eau de vies that you're working on. Like, that's the type of stuff that we love. So, I mean, all I have to say is on behalf of all the bartenders and spirits lovers out there, keep on doing what you're doing, man. And I had one more question. If somebody wanted to purchase some of your products online, where could they do that?
I'm not so good at that, at the commercial yeah. part. I'm such a bad salesman. I so apologize. You can know more about the product at maisonferrand.com and you'll see what we do. I don't have a page book. I'm like this super, you know, stupid guy about that. I'm trying to learn, but I spend most of the time making the product. So I'm so sorry. I'm not selling well, you know.
That's okay.
But I want to say something very important to me is, and I know you got, I listened to your podcast and I think it's wonderful what you're doing, because education is key, is the key to pleasure, you know, and the more you know, the more fun we have. You know, the older I get, I'm 52, been doing this close to 30 years, the more I feel humbled, because the ocean opens, but the pleasure is more and more intense, you know, when you get deep down. And I really want to be so grateful and explain how meaningful it is. You know, this is my vacation. I'm doing a little tour of the U.S. right now, and to see wonderful bartenders so enamored to learn and to want to know what goes into their cocktail and to make sure the products are top-notch and to make sure they know everything about this, to me, is a dream come true. And it's a dream that started small, as you can imagine, you know, and that movement, and you're helping moving the needle too, and the guys listening too, and I'm not just blowing smoke. I mean this. I couldn't do this without people who really cared, with different styles, with products that did meant something. So a big, big thank you to the community.
Oh, thank you so much. All right, guys, there you have it. Thank you so much for tuning in. Again, I'm your host, Eric Castro. Don't forget to like, subscribe, comment, all that stuff. Ask us a question online. We'll be sure to get back to you as soon as we can. Thank you so much, and goodbye.